This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The death toll in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria sparked outrage and denial from President Trump. A new report from Quartz, the Associated Press, and Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism explores the stories behind the numbers, interviewing hundreds of family members of victims and reviewing the testimony of many more. The investigation shows how lack of medical care after the storm contributed to the deaths of hundreds of Puerto Ricans with treatable ailments. Well, joining me for more is senior reporter with Quartz, Ana Campoy. She's one of the journalists who worked on the project. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could explain briefly a little more about these numbers, because we have an official count of 64 dead from the government of Puerto Rico. Then you have a study from George Washington University, which estimated the death toll at 2,975. And in this report, you have a tally of some 500. Just explain kind of how those numbers all mesh together.
Yes, it can be very confusing. So the 64 deaths reported by the government, those are deaths that were certified in the weeks after the hurricane. And they have a name and a last name. And those are the only names of the victims that the government has released. But everybody understood that there had been many more deaths. So the government commissioned a study from George Washington University. And what they did was a statistical analysis, taking the overall number of people who died in Puerto Rico in the months after the hurricane and comparing that to the number of people who usually die during that period of time. And so the difference, which is called excess death, is that 2,175 number, which is essentially a statistical calculation. What we did was we asked people who had a relative who had died because of the hurricane to get in touch with us. And so hundreds of people responded, and then we matched those names against the government's database of everyone who died in Puerto Rico in the months after the hurricane. And so we were able to confirm that those people died, and then that's how we came up with the list.
I guess the government of Puerto Rico has acknowledged that number from the study they commissioned, the nearly 3,000 people, 2,975, they're accepting that's the official death toll. So would you expect that number of 64 to actually increase? Like, are they going to release all those names at some point in the future?
So far, they have not released any additional names of victims. In order to do that, they would have to do the same kind of work that we've been doing, do talk to people one by one, hear their stories, figure out whether the death is related to the hurricane or not. So far, they haven't announced that they're going to do something like that. So based on what I know, I'm not expecting that list to grow.
So what stood out for you about the stories that you heard from family members of victims in the course of reporting for this project and also from the testimonies that you read?
I think what stands out the most is how long it took for the situation to return back to a normal and how long people waited to get the things they needed. And so their deaths were very gradual and slow and painful. And so that is a really tragic thing about this hurricane. I've covered hurricanes in other places, and you have a lot of chaos in the immediate aftermath, but then things go back to normal, and that didn't happen in Puerto Rico.
Would you say that things are now back to normal, or do they still have some ways to go?
They're not completely back to normal. I was there just a couple of weeks ago, and there are some traffic lights that don't work still, for example. There has to be more rebuilding work. So, no, they're not back to normal.
One of the things I think that's interesting about the way you've presented the information is that you kind of have this graphical interpretation of people dying in the aftermath of the storm, and then at the same time you have, for example, the official narrative, you know, the timeline as far as when FEMA starts to pull out some of their resources, what you're hearing from some of the officials on the ground, whether they're from the federal level or the government of Puerto Rico itself. Was it difficult to package all this information because it's such a big and complicated story, and in some ways getting that information has been quite challenging. So was it difficult to figure out a way to present this so that people reading it could sort of grasp it and understand it?
Yes, we had, you know, hundreds of records from people, and how do you combine them to tell their story, you know, without being able to go into every single one of those. And so, as I mentioned before, I think that what stands out the most from this disaster is just how long it took for things to get back to normal. And that was our idea all along, to show why and graphically show exactly how long. And you can see month after month goes by and people keep dying, and you see at the same time how officials on the ground may or may have not been doing what they were supposed to do, or even just the perceptions of what was going on. You know, you have we recorded dozens of deaths at a time when, you know, by the time that you had people like Donald Trump saying, you know, oh, there's only 16 dead, we had already we documented cases that of dozens of people who had died by that point. And so the story continued to unroll that same way. You know, our partner, the Center for Investigative Journalism, they were doing all this work on the ground, showing and documenting more deaths and publishing it. And at the time, officials dismissed those reports. So you can see that part of the reason why people continued dying for so long had to do with officials not accepting or not knowing how many people had died.
Mm-hmm. Were there some surprising things or counterintuitive things that this study, this analysis revealed too? For example, the demographics about people that were dying and maybe some of those things kind of turning what you expected on its head?
So for the most part, the results are pretty much what you would expect from a situation like this. But so in other hurricanes and disasters, we know that the elderly and people with pre-existing conditions are the ones who are the most affected. But we also saw a spike in the death rate for young people. And so during these months, we heard from many young people who died because of accidents. For example, someone was run over because a traffic light didn't work. Another person got electrocuted as he was trying to hook up a house into the electric grid. So this disaster also affected young people who were healthy.
Mm-hmm. Which is something you might not expect to see. We're talking with Anna Campoy. She's a senior reporter with Quartz, talking about a new report from the Associated Press, Quartz, and Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism, exploring the aftermath of Hurricane Maria and people who died in the aftermath of that storm. One of the other things that's interesting about the study is you sort of break it down as far as the results of, for example, lack of power, lack of access to medical care, and other kind of infrastructure issues that happened as a result of the storm, and those kind of being directly contributing to the deaths of these folks. Was there one thing that really stood out there out of that whole panoply of problems?
Lack of electricity. Most of the people that we heard from listed that as a cause. And many, oftentimes it was a mix of all of those things. You know, they listed lack of electricity, lack of communications, lack of medical care, but most of them listed lack of electricity because that had such a big impact on everything else, really.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it might be a case of a streetlight being out, so somebody gets run over in an accident which wouldn't have otherwise happened. In another case, it may be they aren't able to hook up like a, you know, a CPAP machine or something like that. A whole range of reasons why having access to electricity is pretty crucial for some of these ailments, right?
Yes, exactly.
What about the impact on medical staff in Puerto Rico too? I imagine for those folks, it must be pretty frustrating and heartbreaking knowing that they can't provide the level of care that they would obviously want to in this situation.
Yes, I'm sure. It was a very difficult time for anyone in the public health system. And the other thing that happened after the hurricane is that people started to leave because they couldn't live or work there. And so you had doctors and dentists and nurses, they left and because they, you know, the situation was really hard. And so then you had a shortage of health providers, and that made things worse.
There's a link in many of these cases made by family members between the death of a loved one and infrastructure damage on the island, like power outages, as you were saying. What's been the response of the government of Puerto Rico to this, and why is that important?
Well, we asked for interviews with the governor, with the director of public safety, and the head of the health department, but they didn't grant us interviews. So from what they've said publicly, the governor has recognized that the response, the local government's response was lacking, and he's announced a few measures to improve. So, I mean, ultimately, as we were talking before, the access to power is so important, and the governor himself said last month that the electric grid is in the same state or worse than before the hurricane.
So if another major storm were to hit Puerto Rico, what's the prognosis?
It doesn't look good. It doesn't look good at all. We have to remember that Puerto Rico has been in an economic recession for more than a decade. The local government is bankrupt. They have all sorts of money problems, and so it's not easy for them to rebuild the electric system, and it's going to take a lot of money because of those economic problems, it hadn't been maintained properly, and so it's not a problem that you can solve in a year.
Aside from obviously what you would hope that the government of Puerto Rico has learned, or even what the federal government has learned about responding to this particular storm, are there other things, Ana Campoy, which other states, for example, could learn about how to respond to a storm and how to do it differently if another big storm comes through?
Yes, I think that there's a lot to learn from Puerto Rico, and we have to look into the data and what people tell us to learn those lessons. But I can tell you some things that would have prevented some deaths, especially among the elderly and the vulnerable and people who were vulnerable. There should have been some sort of emergency healthcare center for them to go to, a place that would have been appropriately supplied with food and water and electricity so that they could continue their treatment. Another thing is, for example, setting up emergency dialysis centers. That was another huge issue. They all closed so people couldn't get dialysis, and they died because of that. So that's one, that's an area where other places could improve. Just ensuring that the people who need the most care are safe.
What's the takeaway then from this story?
For me, the biggest takeaway is how important having an accurate death toll is. And it doesn't have to be accurate to the number, but just having a general idea of how many people are dying, because that turned out to be crucial in deciding, in the case of the federal government, for example, in deciding how seriously to take this and how much help to send. And so if you don't know how many people this is affecting, it's really hard to figure out how to respond and how much help is needed. And I think Puerto Rico and other places just have to do a better job of counting the dead.
Ana Campoy is a senior reporter with Quartz. She is one of the reporters who worked on a new report from Quartz, the Associated Press, and Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism, exploring the stories behind the numbers, behind the death toll in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. They interviewed hundreds of family members of victims and reviewed the testimony of many more who who died in the aftermath of that storm. Anna Campoy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come, UCF professor Fernando Rivera has been studying the Puerto Rican diaspora for years. The hurricane brought more urgency to his research. A conversation with Fernando Rivera about his Puerto Rico research hub when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. University of Central Florida sociology professor Fernando Rivera has been studying the Puerto Rican community in Central Florida for years. The hurricane brought more urgency to his research and led to the foundation of the Puerto Rico Research Hub. Professor Fernando Rivera is the director of UCF's Puerto Rico Research Hub. Thanks for joining us again on Intersection.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So the Research Hub is going to be formally inaugurated on September 19th. Tell me how the hub came about and what was your idea for putting it together?
So the hub came about, I think, as UCF reaction to a community need. For a long time, part of my research was looking at the Puerto Rican diaspora here in Central Florida. And as you know, and many of your listeners might know, this has been an ongoing phenomena for the last decade or more here in Central Florida. When Hurricane Maria hit and it became apparent that there was going to be a lot of devastation, Central Florida became sort of this rescue hub, if you might want to call it. And that's brought about a lot of attention into what were our institutions here in Central Florida doing to assist our growing Puerto Rican population. So the hub comes out of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
How can we utilize the university built on research to basically establish those partnerships and try to come up with some solutions to the challenges and the issues that we're facing?
So have you started to form some of those relationships already?
Absolutely. So some of these ideas have been sort of published in other news outlets. And the reception has been amazing. I think for the Puerto Rican community here in Central Florida, it was finally a recognition that somebody's paying attention to me. Somebody's paying attention to the needs of my community. And that was a long time coming. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it took Hurricane Maria to awaken sort of that attention to this community. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm a hopeful person. I'm positive. So if this was sort of an outcome of that storm, then let it be. And I think moving forward, you know, today is going to be Puerto Rico, but we're going to continue to have these circumstances where somebody's going to need our help. And I think we're shifting a little bit of what is the role of the university in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
What can universities do outside of, you know, the traditional things that we do in terms of research, in terms of providing courses and curriculum and service? What other things can we do? And I'm very excited to be in this position to provide kind of like that service out here for our growing Puerto Rican population here in Central Florida and for our growing Puerto Rican student population as well.
Is the hub just you at this point, or do you have some other some researchers working alongside you?
Well, right now it's just me, but I have many collaborators, and we're in the process of building up. There's amazing talent at UCF. There's a lot of researchers throughout the United States that reach out to me, and they want to be part of this historic sort of movement and sort of this historic topic that is going to be continue to be an issue of research and investigation for the foreseeable future.
There are already some pretty strong ties between UCF and Puerto Rico. I mean, you mentioned the student population, which is one part of it, but also there's that observatory in Puerto Rico. So I think some of those links exist already, right? And I guess, as you say, Hurricane Maria has just cast more of a spotlight on them.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very exciting to have the Puerto Rican Observatory in Arecibo as part of the portfolio of UCF. That is amazing. And actually, we're contemplating some plans to continue those partnerships and have the Puerto Rico Research Hub being part of those efforts out there. And we continue to have. I mean, we have individually and as an institution, I did travel to Puerto Rico in February of last year, And I met with wonderful faculty members at the University of Puerto Rico in Río Piedras, at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez. And, you know, just listening to the concerns of the faculty members and the students down in Puerto Rico, because my viewpoint, I come from the perspective that I don't need to be doing research on things that Puerto Rican researchers in the island are doing, mm-hmm. and are doing an outstanding job. I don't think that's my role. But if they need my help, if they need my assistance, if there's anything that we can provide, more than happy to establish those partnerships.
Have those universities in Puerto Rico become something of a hub for community members there? Like, have they sort of been able to help some of those struggling communities, whether it's with practical things like infrastructure and communication and the like?
Yeah, there's a lot of initiatives going on in Puerto Rico, and I can tell you when I was there in February, there were professors at the University of Puerto Rico from the Public Health Department that were teaming up with communities in Utuado, which is sort of the center of the island, and they were sort of doing those collaborations. So that's happening in Puerto Rico already. Unfortunately, you know, the financial crisis in the island is having real financial consequences for the universities, especially for the public universities in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So the financial cuts are real. There's a lot of uncertainty on the part of faculty, especially in the social sciences, I might say, in terms of, you know, can we go on and continue to have the level and quality of research that we have? Because, you know, there's potential cuts to the university system. And that's something that concerns me, and that's some of the sort of the worrisome aspects that I've heard from a lot of my Puerto Rican colleagues in Puerto Rico.
We're talking to Professor Fernando Rivera. He's the director of UCF's Puerto Rico Research Hub. And I guess from the point of view of the students, has the storm, did Maria take a bite out of the student population too? Are they seeing enrollment slip at some of those universities?
So enrollment has gone down. And obviously, Hurricane Maria had something to do with it, but it's also part of the financial crisis that is ongoing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was telling you before, this movement of people to Central Florida and other areas of the continental United States is not new. It continues to happen. So that's taking a big toll. A lot of the families that have the resources and the means to really move to the continental United States are looking for a better future for their kids. And we're seeing that. A lot of the students that we have at UCF, some were the ones that were displaced by the storm, but others came here when they were 16, 17, you know, parents that lost their jobs, their businesses didn't work out. So they're looking for the future out there. And, you know, in terms of if you look at the demographic profile of the people in Puerto Rico, it's a little bit older on the demographic profile here in Central Florida. So it's an issue of concern as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're seeing it with the educational reforms that are going on at the K-12 level in Puerto Rico and obviously at the university level as well.
So what are some of the aspects of the research that you're going to be focusing on? Are there some key areas that you really want to drill down to and figure out what's going on and how institutions, whether it's UCF, whether it's other public institutions or even private companies can help Puerto Rico or the Puerto Ricans who've moved to Central Florida now?
Well, and one of the things, starting out is probably sort of my research interest in terms of what I've done in the past. And I've looked at sort of the health outcomes of Puerto Ricans in the continental United States. And sort of investigating, you know, are we ready? Are those patterns are going to continue to happen after the storm or not, and as people continue to move here, mm-hmm. To Central Florida. But one of the things that I hope to accomplish just by talking to you and the event that I have on this 19, I want the community input. I want people to tell me what will be more useful for that. And this is about collaboration. And again, I've been very humble in the last 2 weeks in the amount of calls from different groups willing to help. And I'm talking from, you know, individuals in the community to chambers of commerce to research groups to different people out here. So somehow putting this out there has touched a nerve in this community. And I'm very humble that I'm the one that gets to lead that initiative.
What have you found, like looking at healthcare, for example, in your research over the years? Like, what are some of the takeaways?
Well, kind of like the takeaways, if you compare Puerto Ricans to other Latino groups in the United States, usually we have the not so proud designation of having the worst health outcomes, which goes against the grain of our basically our sociological mentality that, you know, if you have more access to resources, there should be a comparable advantage in terms of health. Mm-hmm. But one of the aspects of my research that I continue to find is sort of the issue of residential segregation. Basically, you know, when we have a group of people that are put together in areas where there's no opportunity for growth, that's where we started seeing those health outcomes.
And you're seeing that here in Central Florida?
So in 2010, a colleague of mine, Giovanni Burgos over at Delphi University, and myself did a study looking just at that in terms of disability outcomes and sort of the role of residential segregation. And we just recently ran some preliminary numbers from the U.S. Census, and we're starting to see those patterns. And those patterns are a little bit worrisome because we don't want to reproduce what happened in the Northeast in the 1940s when we had sort of that first big migration of Puerto Ricans to the continental United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so from the sociological literature, those types of residential segregation just lead to absolutely, you know, absolute poverty levels, cycles of poverties, not necessarily the outcomes that we want. And I think right now in Central Florida, we have this great opportunity to make sure that doesn't happen here.
What about language? I talked recently to the Adult Literacy League, and they have a lot of students who are looking for tutors right now. And a lot of them are from Puerto Rico, many of them from Venezuela and other places as well. Is that something that you're looking into too, like access to things that could help, whether it's in Spanish language or access to education in English for folks where, you know, English isn't their first language?
No, absolutely. And, you know, in UCF, we have an English Language Institute. And, you know, sort of looking at the vision of the future, you know, that's some of the resources that we can provide to the community. And obviously, this is where, you know, corporate sponsorships and sponsorships from different people in the community can make a difference, you know, to pay for those type of services that are already available. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, we can assess the level of English language fluency that you have, and those type of programs can be customized for people. Language is a big issue, as you know, in terms of, you know, your prospects for social mobility, in terms of the type of jobs that you might get. And this is, again, kind of like goes back to this issue of residential segregation, right? If mm-hmm. you move to an area where Spanish is the primary language, it might keep you from, you know, achieving that social mobility and, you know, getting jobs that might pay a little bit better than just the sort of the entry-level jobs where you don't have like this public-facing type of experience.
I mean, if you flip that on its head, should there be more resources available in Spanish? You know, should cities and counties make more of an effort to reach out to these communities in their own language, in Spanish?
And absolutely. I mean, and you know, unbeknownst to most people, there's no official language in the United States.
Right. It depends on who you talk to, though. Yeah. Some people are convinced that the official language is English.
Which is, oddly enough, Puerto Rico does have two official languages.
Mm-hmm.
We are English and Spanish.
But not in the continental U.S.
Exactly. So we know that, you know, we had the controversy in terms of, you know, whether the ballots were going to be available for Puerto Ricans and other groups in Spanish. That will take, you know, some type of leadership if you really want to incorporate Spanish speakers into your communities, right? And we see some areas of success, right? I think the city of Orlando has done a wonderful job of seeing language not as a barrier, but an actual asset. And I think I've seen that with some of our students that are coming from Puerto Rico, that they can actually double their job prospects because they're getting educated in English. But let me tell you, when you go to a Latin American country and you're going to close that business deal and you have that language background, it's going to make a difference.
Getting back to some of the research you're doing, I'm wondering if part of that is also trying to get a fix on just exactly how Hurricane Maria affected that diaspora, because there have been numbers thrown around, there have been estimates, but it seems to be a little bit hard to pin down exactly how many people left the island after the hurricane and have moved here and maybe stayed put in Central Florida.
I mean, that's another aspect of, you know, eye-opening sort of or reality check types of moments, right, that we are unable to count our population, right? And sometimes we have to rely on the U.S. Census, the American Community Survey. Sometimes we have statistics at the state level that really don't define Hispanic background. So it's becoming sort of that sort of challenge of pinpointing that. At the end of the day, we know that a lot of people are here. We know that the financial crisis is continuing in Puerto Rico. And the recovery from the hurricane, a lot of it took place here. And that's a very unique situation. You know, think about the supplies that were gathered here in Central Florida. People flew here. They flew here. This was a shelter. This was probably a over-the-sea type of shelter that we had, because simply the reality of being an island. And there was nowhere to go for a lot of people in Puerto Rico. So Central Florida provided that refuge. And I have to say that the level of welcome that this community provided was amazing. You know, and you saw it in the welcome centers that were at the airport here in Orlando, in Tampa, in Miami, and other places. You know, the resources were here. So in that sense, Central Florida became a place of recovery for a lot of people. A lot of people took advantage of that opportunity to put their lives back together, figure out what the things that were going on. Again, our advantage of having a large Puerto Rican population here in Central Florida allowed people to have that little break from the issues that were going on in the island, figure out what's going on. Some of them had the ability to go back and continue sort of the recovery back in the island. But for some of them, and, you know, and this is something that we have every right as U.S. citizens, decided to stay here. And that's something that we need to welcome, and that's something that provided a lot of opportunities for those that were in that situation after the hurricane.
Professor Fernando Rivera, director of UCF's Puerto Rico Research Hub, good luck as you move ahead with the project, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, the oral histories of Hurricane Maria evacuees, a conversation with journalist Maria Padilla, who's writing a book about the aftermath of the hurricane. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Maria Padilla is the founder of OrlandoLatino.org. She's a former reporter for the Orlando Sentinel and the founding editor of El Sentinel. She's writing a book about the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Maria, welcome back to Intersection.
Thank you, Matthew.
It's been a while. We had you last on the show back in February. It was about 5 months after the hurricane. Quite a lot has changed since then. Just tell us what you've been up to.
Well, shortly after I was here, I was approached about the possibility of writing a book. I have been working with Nancy Rosado, who's also well-known in the community as having worked with the Pulse survivors and mm-hmm. family members and so forth. And we wanted to document the oral histories of the people who came from Puerto Rico here, the evacuees, to kind of preserve those stories. So we have been kind of shopping that idea around. However, we then became approached by a mutual academic friend who knew of an interest by the Universities of Florida Press to actually get a book going on this subject. It's had such a huge impact on the state of Florida. And so this is how we came to actually, everything kind of came together. And so now we're working on this project.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the motivation for the book.
Yes. Well, you know, I've been a longtime journalist here in Orlando and in other cities where I've worked. And when you work in a daily newspaper environment, you're really kind of putting together a story in bits and pieces. And you're working for the next day's deadline. If you're lucky, maybe you have a week's deadline or something like that.
Your editor is nice to you.
Exactly. So what I wanted to do and what I was dissatisfied with, and what Nancy and I both talked about, was that we weren't really hearing the whole stories. That the stories of what actually happened to people was getting lost in all of the aftermath and what was going to happen and how much money was going to come to the island and what was the devastation and all the things that normally you do want to know about, but which kind of obscure the emotional and mental trauma that people have experienced and continue to experience. So that's how we started talking about it, and we started to collect oral stories, literally taping people, videotaping them, audio files, the whole nine yards, photography, and just to try to collect the stories, and we tried to kind of start shopping that around.
Mm-hmm. How did you find the people who are the subject of the stories in your book?
It has been totally, I won't want to say happenstance, because we worked hard to find people, but we just started knocking on doors, and we started going to hotels and motels, and through word of mouth, this person recommended us to that person, and this person recommended us to the other person, and so we started hearing about people like that till we came up with a sufficient number of people.
How many people have you talked to so far?
Oh, well, we've got well over a dozen people that we have talked to. They're very long stories, sort of like uninterrupted stories. We really want to hear what happened to you. And so they can be very long files. So we've talked to quite a number of people at this point in time.
And is it interviews over the course of many months? Because I imagine people's experience is going to change. You know, they might have just come to Florida. They might have sort of not be sure what they're going to do next. And then a couple months later, they're like, I do know what's going on, or I'm still kind of finding my way.
Yes. What we have found is people in various stages of adjustment. So some people are a lot more adjusted than others. Some people have more resources than others. Some people are in better health than others. Some people are just arrived. Some people have been here for months. I mean, literally, we've talked to people who came here just days after the hurricane, which is incredible. We've talked to people who came here on humanitarian flights. It's just a real gamut of the experiences of these folks.
And do all of them have some kind of family connections here to Florida, or are there some who just arrived and they didn't know anybody?
A few did not know anyone, but almost all of them have some connection here. They might know someone or of someone. They might have a family member, even though maybe it's not a close family member. So, yes, it's they have some connection to Florida, either directly, slightly indirectly, only because they've heard so many people, so many Puerto Ricans are now in Florida that this might be the best place to be.
I'm wondering, having spent all this time, all these many months talking to these folks, collecting these stories, what are some of the themes that you're seeing? And I'm wondering if your kind of understanding of these evacuees' experience has changed from what you expected when you set out on this project.
Yes, yes. My understanding of it has changed and continues to change over time. Remember that we have to sit initially for the interview, which takes a number of hours sometimes. And what you hear in the beginning, because you're trying to get it all down. The journalist in me wants to get it all down. And then when you sit down, you try to translate and transcribe that interview. You're listening to these stories over and over again. And that has had a big impact on me. It's very difficult, actually, to listen to the stories of what actually happened to people and the suffering and the trauma that they have continued to experience, because they're kind of out of sorts, if you know what I mean. They're not where they normally would want to be. They're not on the island. They're not in their old home. They're not around. They don't have the same neighbors. They don't have the same friends. Family members are far. They're trying to figure out how Florida works. What is Central Florida like? I mean, how do you do these things here? Language from many people is somewhat of an issue. People will always tell you, I understand some English, but it may be a little halting and they're not very comfortable speaking it.
Florida's kind of hard to work out even for people who've been here a long time, right?
Well, could you imagine? And now you're coming here and in an emergency situation. Some people brought next to nothing with them. Some people just came with one or two suitcases and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you sort all that out? How do you kind of get yourself together again after something like that has happened to you?
Do you feel like enough has been done to help people who had to leave Puerto Rico?
No, absolutely not. The response has been kind of haphazard throughout. both here and in Puerto Rico, to be completely fair, both on the local government level and the island administration level and the federal government level. It's been rather haphazard. And I think that has also added to the difficulty that many people are having in trying to adjust to and just sort of start all over again.
Maria Padilla, you've spent a lot of time reporting on not just the situation of Puerto Ricans in Central Florida, but of course what's been going on back in the island. I mean, I remember talking to you before the hurricane hit, and we were talking about, you know, the potential of statehood for Puerto Rico, some of the economic strife that the island is going through. Does it surprise you that the response has been a bit haphazard from all these different levels?
No, nor should it surprise anybody else, because when this hurricane hit Puerto Rico, the island was reeling, literally, from a 10-year economic recession, stagnation, where tens of thousands of people were leaving every year, coming to states like Florida and elsewhere. They had not recovered from that economic recession that really kind of began in 2006. So all of a sudden, you superimpose on that a nearly Category 5 hurricane that levels the entire island. I mean, just level the entire island. And you have, you know, your government is broke. Your government is broke. Literally in May of 2017, the fiscal board, oversight board that oversees Puerto Rico, which is a different story, they had declared a kind of bankruptcy for the island. So just five months before the Hurricane Maria hits, you have the island declaring bankruptcy. So that automatically sets the stage for very, very difficult time dealing with this hurricane.
I'm wondering, if you look at what Puerto Rico has done to get, first of all, the electric grid back up and running. I mean, it took a while to get everybody connected again, right? Like, it was almost an entire year before the lights came on in every community. Do you think there's an opportunity lost here to rebuild and do it in a way that is more resilient?
Well, here's the thing. Under federal laws and under FEMA, they will help you rebuild to what it was before, to whatever state of your electric grid, your water and sewage system, or whatever other infrastructure you're talking about was right before the hurricane. When you think about it logically, on one level, it makes sense. On the other level, if you're Puerto Rico, it makes no sense at all, because everything was such a state of disrepair. And very little investment had been made in the island's infrastructure for the problems that I just cited, which was that 10-year recession, the bankruptcy, and the borrowing more money just to kind of stay afloat, not necessarily to invest in anything. So that's been one of the difficulties. The opportunity now, if you want to call it that, is, yeah, they have to rebuild. Mm-hmm. They have to rebuild. They have to rebuild stronger, better, different. And that also will be costly. It will take a long time. My understanding is that Puerto Rico is facing something like 20 years of recuperation on top of the lost decade. So I'm not quite sure how that's all going to work out. It's going to be very difficult.
The people you've spoken to for your book, do they want to go back to Puerto Rico and have some of them returned?
I ask everyone that question. The answer is no. They do not want to go back. It's not because they don't love the island. They love the island. They miss it dearly. But they have suffered a great deal. And they've come around to the understanding that they can't go back to what they left behind, because what they left behind there was the basis of so much suffering for them. And there was so very little help, or there was so very little recourse for them on the island, that that's why they're here, quite frankly. So many of them miss Puerto Rico deeply, but very few of them actually say they want to go back.
How does that sort of factor into this notion of, and you mentioned before that a lot of Puerto Ricans were leaving for better opportunities on the mainland? Like,
that's right. In fact, there was a historic migration already underway before Hurricane Maria hit, known as the millennial migration. That migration is basically from about 2006 forward, when the recession really starts to hit the island and folks just start leaving because there's very little economic opportunity for them there. Everything starts getting squeezed. You know, life on the island starts feeling small, I guess, for a lot of people. And so that was already happening, and we were already seeing over 350,000, 400,000 people had come to mostly Florida, I think entirely to Florida, mm-hmm. if my numbers are correct. So the hurricane happened, and now that is accelerated. So we had an accelerated historical migration that was then further pushed by the hurricane. So people just start saying, I can't stay here. And depending on the estimates that you look at, and yes, there are always different estimates, probably about 50 to 60, 70,000 people came just to the state of Florida. In the immediate aftermath of the storm, that's the number of people that you might see in a year's time. And in immediate aftermath, you have that number of people. That is enormous. It has enormous implications for Puerto Rico because they're losing their working age population and therefore their tax base and their workforce. For Florida, of course, it has enormous implications because now you have a even larger Puerto Rican population. There were already over a million of us here in Florida. So now that has accelerated. It changes the face of that diaspora. It sort of makes it a little bit more complicated. Really fascinating questions that this whole thing has raised.
Just how much of an influence do you think Puerto Rico or the impact of Hurricane Maria is going to have on the election in Florida in November?
Oh, my goodness. That's kind of debatable, I think, because everybody wants to push Puerto Ricans to vote, especially the newcomers. They realize that as Puerto Ricans, everyone is a U.S. citizen, and once they have a permanent address here, they can just vote. They could just sign up and vote. Yes, all of that is true. I am not sure, based on the number of interviews that you know, we have done, that the mindset is there. People are just not thinking in that way. And I think to some degree it kind of re-stresses. It's a sort of additional stressor on the people to think that way. Yes, you ought to vote if you can. Yes, you should register to vote. You should do all those things. Electoral participation in Puerto Rico is actually quite high.
Yeah.
Most of the time, with or without a hurricane. But I'm not sure that people are thinking that way here because they find everything so different and they're just so feeling their way around. Mm-hmm. But then you have various groups that are really pushing people to vote, to register, to become politically involved. Some people will hear that message and they will do that. You know, that's right up their alley. But for other people, and I would venture to say most people, they kind of hang back and want to figure out, what's it like here? Let me figure out. Let me get my bearings here. And many people don't appreciate that push necessarily. So it could have a pushback.
When does your book come out?
Well, I am under deadline right now, so we are finishing up the book. And we have a couple of weeks, actually, to deliver all the goods, as they say. And I would imagine it'll be maybe 6 months or more from there before you actually see the finished product. So right now I am putting the, you know, pedal to the metal.
Maria Padilla, she's the founder of OrlandoLatino.org. She's writing a book about the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can find us on the NPR One app, download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.